We're back in our study of 1 Corinthians. Any comments or lingering questions from prior conversations, prior weeks, before we get started? Don't want to jump in too quickly. If not, as a review of chapters 5 and 6 over the last couple of weeks, the topics included expel the immoral brother, which indicated the tolerance of sexual sin in particular was not a good thing. So the Corinthians seem to, at least, be allowing for, condoning maybe, or at least not taking action toward this immoral brother. But then the kind of that expanded from there, Paul did, that the immoral won't inherit the kingdom. And he has a list in chapter 5, and then he repeats much of it in chapter 6. It wasn't exclusively in a sexual category, but that was part of the focus that Paul had there. Chapter 6, verses 12 through 20 were more focused on sexual immorality, sexuality, and it was important to have that conversation last time. So we're going to move forward now into chapter 7, and some of the themes are a bit consistent from there. So it's actually a good building block. The way that Paul writes, he has a foundation, which is really God's word and holiness, and then builds from there to help us understand. So unpacking, you know, activity that was maybe happening in Corinth, and then our conversation includes how does that apply to us. So today's scriptures, really, it's all 1 Corinthians chapter 7. So let's dive into the text, into chapter 7. It begins a new section. Really, what's happening now is there's questions from the Corinthians that are being answered. So Paul repeats the questions and then submits some answers to them. It is a new section, but the first topic is closely connected to what has come before. Chapter 7 begins with Paul's reaction against ascetic ideas that marriage and sexuality are not befitting a Christian's spiritual experience. So this idea comes up from time to time. It's not new, but it does exist in our time, that somehow the body and physical experience is less holy than spiritual things. And so it leads to the whole kind of ascetic lifestyle, the, you know, going off to be by yourself or dedicating one's whole life is not a bad thing necessarily, but it's not necessarily a better thing than living by God's plan and design. All right. Make sense? Let's jump into the text and we'll get more of that as we go. Will someone read verses 1 through 7 of 1 Corinthians chapter 7?
I'll take it. Now for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. But since sexual immorality is occurring, each man should have sexual relationships with his own wife and each woman with her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife and likewise the wife of her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. In the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife. Do not deprive each other except perhaps by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I say this as a concession, not as a command. I wish that all of you were as I am, but each of you has your own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that.
Thank you, Andrea. So verse 1 from chapter 7 says something about it is good. So the question that arises is, and this is an interpretive possibility, is to treat the words as a quote of the Corinthian letter. So the Corinthians wrote to Paul with some questions. You know, what do we do about, you know, how about this situation or whatever? And so now he's writing back. So in the ESV text, at least, so he says, now concerning the matters about which you wrote, and then there's a quote there. So the quote mark is quoting the text of what they sent to him, okay? So that's an interpretive possibility. The prior NIV version, the NIV 1984, didn't have a quote there. And that then implies that Paul is making that as a statement. So it's really a tricky thing. Is Paul quoting what they ask about to remind them of their question, or is Paul making a statement? It is good. So this is an ESV that I'm reading from. It is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. Is that Paul or is that Corinth making that claim or that statement? That really sets up how we interpret and how we understand what he goes on to say. I like the quote marks on it. I like the interpretation that it's quoting the Corinthians, because then it really helps us understand the rest of what Paul writes about in a better way. I think if he makes that statement in chapter 7, verse 1, it's good for a man not to have sexual relationship with a woman. That makes it kind of a struggle for the rest of what we see him writing, okay? Now, he does go on and say later down in the chapter that if someone can remain single, that's a good thing. So, you know, that's why it's subject to interpretation. It's not explicitly clear. In verse 2, he talks about immorality and links that directly. So that links us directly back to the discussion prior in chapter 6 about prostitution, sexual immorality, specifically in chapter 6, but also kind of stretching back into chapter 5. And then in verse 5 is literally stop depriving. So the way my text reads, and I think Andrea, yours was similar, do not deprive one another. The language literally, probably a more accurate translation would be stop depriving, which really carries a different meaning to it, right? A do not, and parents, we can recognize this. We've done this probably, don't do that is different from stop doing that, right? Don't sets a limit on things. Stop is like an intervention into a current activity. So if verse 5, literally, if Paul is saying stop depriving one another, then that was going on in Corinth. So then if verse 1 is Paul saying it is good that you don't do that, then why at verse 5 would he say don't deprive? It seems like he would say it's fine, keep depriving each other. Okay, make sense? We good on that? He has a balanced approach to both husbands and wives through this section that we can see, and that's helpful for interpreting things further down as well, right? I mean, each man has a wife, each woman her husband. The husband should give conjugal rights, the wife for her husband. That's verse 3. Verse 4 is the wife does not have authority. The husband does likewise. The husband does not have authority, but the wife does. So there's this balance. It goes back and forth. So then what are Paul's conditions for abstinence within a marriage? This is verse 5.
Mutual consent or agreement.
Very good. That's item number 1 on the list.
Primarily for devotion reasons.
Yep. Temporarily and for the purpose of prayer or yet devotionally. Yeah, exactly. So those are the reasons why Paul would allow it. But he does say for a time, right? And then at the end of that verse, the Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control, which I think we can understand. Jump into verse 7. I wish that all were as I am, or something similar to that, depending on the translation you have. Gift. So Paul's status, we'll discuss that with verse 8 in terms of being unmarried, okay? He hasn't said that yet. The context of end of verse 5 that we saw about self-control, and then again in verse 9, he may still be referring to self-control because he hasn't said he's single. So, I mean, if you look at the end of verse 5, that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control, then, I say this as a concession, not a command. I wish all were like I am. So is that Paul's ability to exercise self-control, or is it that he's a single guy? Well, he hasn't said yet that he's a single guy, but the Corinthians probably know him, so they know that. So he wouldn't have to say it explicitly. So that's a tough thing as well. What's he really saying? I wish everyone were like me. It's not clear in the text precisely what he means. But the summary of this section is this: marriage is the norm. It's a good thing. It's God's design. Married people belong to each other. So, you know, authority over the body, etc. That's, we're connected, we're one flesh union, and sexuality within the context of marriage is good. Okay, makes sense? And that's different from how we might interpret this if we think Paul is saying in verse one, it is good that a man not have sexual relations. The rest of that makes it certainly seem like it's a quote from the Corinthians, and that's why we like to interpret it that way. Clear? Good? If so, we'll move into the next piece. All right. Verses 8 and 9. Short section this time. Will someone read that?
I'll read it. To the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion.
All right. Thanks, Barry. Unmarried here. So, to the unmarried, what does that mean? Does that mean they're never married? Well, there's a good argument that Paul is addressing widowers, not those who are never married. And here, this is how that argument is made. There's a balance of husband and wives. We saw that in the first section, right? So if we think, okay, Paul's addressing both wives and husbands and wives here. And now he says to the unmarried and widows. Well, in the there's no Greek word in the Septuagint. That's the LXX abbreviation, Roman numeral 70. So the Septuagint or the New Testament. So it's the Old Testament in Greek or the New Testament, which is Greek. There's no word in there that literally means widower. So the masculine noun for one who has lost a spouse. So there's no widower word. And Paul does use that same word, that same Greek word that he uses here as unmarried, or is translated here as unmarried. So he does use that elsewhere for those who have been married at some point. So is he saying to the never married and the widows, it's good to remain single? And then he tips his hand, as I am, right? Or is he saying to the widowers and the widows, it's good to remain single? Interesting question. I like it that way because it puts it all in one context, and it's not never married and widowers, and crossing the whole range of single people. It's more of a specific kind of subset of those who are not married, those who have lost a spouse. So that's a possibility. Can't definitively say that because, again, we don't have Paul's intention. We just have the words on the page that we get to try to interpret. In verse 8, Paul indicates that he is unmarried. So that also brings up a question. Was Paul ever married? Anybody have a thought on that?
I don't know. How are we to know?
Exactly. We can't know specifically, but the text could imply that he was a widower.
Because it's in that same context.
Yeah, because in that context, exactly, in verse 8, if you take that as a widower and a widow, then he puts himself in that narrow slice, right? Remain single as I am doing, right? It's not certain, so we can't know for sure. But Jewish men were expected to be married. And Saul, who he was before Paul, was like, he was the Jew of Jews, right? He was the Hall of Famer, the guy who did it all. You know, Pharisee, zealot, all the things that Paul lists. He never lists having been married, but that would have been an expectation on him, on his life. So we don't know. So it's possible that Paul was married and was either widowed, or maybe his wife left him and he doesn't get into that. Why? Well, maybe he finds it painful to write about it, talk about it, even think about it. Who knows? But there is a distinct possibility that Paul had been married at some point in his life. We just can't say that he was single forever because he never actually does. He only says that he is single in the context of writing this letter. Verse 9, if they cannot exercise self-control, can self-control be attained by human effort? Self-control is sometimes pretty difficult. And it seems like different people have different temptations or kind of hot buttons, as the expression goes, right? There are certain things that are easier for some people than they are for others. And so I think that's part of what Paul is talking about here. He uses the word self-control, your lack of self-control, or they cannot exercise self-control. For some, that's not as difficult as for others. And I think Paul recognizes that difference. At the end of verse 9, it's better to marry than to burn with passion. The "with passion" is not in the Greek, actually. The Greek simply reads, it's better to marry than to burn. So it's an acceptable clarification to help us understand it's not either get married or get burned at the stake. But that's not in the original language, which is just an interesting factoid. Summary of this section, just two verses, that widows and widowers, if we take it that way, which I think is a good possibility. So they should remain single if they have self-control, if they can do it. But if they're tempted to visit prostitutes or have affairs, then they should marry because that's better, right? And in the culture of Corinth, you know, a reminder of how Corinth was, you know, Corinth going to the temple and visiting a prostitute was not even socially challenging. That was normal behavior for people. So if the temptation was there for that reason, or to that end, then it's better to marry. Or, you know, extramarital affair of some kind, better to be married and have your own spouse. Okay, moving on. Verses 10 and 11, another short section.
To the married I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And the husband should not divorce his wife.
Here he's addressing married people who are both Christians. At least that's the, I think, best way to interpret this. This is how Lockwood's commentary takes it, because mixed marriages are discussed further down in the chapter. So if he's addressing one spouse is a Christian and one's not, which is what I mean by mixed marriages there, then why does he repeat that later on? So, and there's a little bit different way that he describes things in terms of marriage and staying married and things like that. So the understanding is he's talking to married people who are both believers. And the summary is this: no divorce. Believers should get reconciled. How would this compare to Jesus' words about divorce? And we could look all these up if we wanted to. Matthew 5 and verse 32, and again 19:9. Mark chapter 10, verse 9, Luke 16, verse 18. And we could also look at Malachi chapter 2, verses 14 to 16. What's the Bible say about divorce? Or what did Jesus say about it? Is Paul going down a new track?
Well, without looking those all up, I remember one occasion somebody said that was talking to Jesus about that. He says, well, Moses said that we have a decree. If we really need to, we can divorce our wives. And but Jesus responded back and said, well, that was only because of the hardness of men's heart that he said that decree was given. But that's not the way it was supposed to be.
Right, exactly. And, you know, that's very prevalent in our culture, in our society as well. And it happens, and sometimes, you know, differences are irreconcilable. So it's not like that is it's somehow, you know, unforgivable or whatever, or different from all the rest of what we've talked about. He's saying that, you know, striving to remain married is the design that God had. And it's similar to what Jesus said, right? But that was contrary to the liberal views of Rabbi Hillel, who was teaching in the Jewish community that, you know, husbands could say, I divorce you three times, and that was a done deal. Pretty easy, right? In Greco-Roman society, where probably the view on marriage was pretty limited in terms of its sanctity, right? The people would get married or not get married, and, you know, whatever they did would be fine. So contrary to that, Paul was encouraging the people to stay married, to be reconciled if they separated, but to keep the marriage, to stay connected. Okay. Good on that. Wives divorcing husbands was really not permitted in Jewish law. So it would be a husband divorcing a wife. So it's interesting that Paul puts it in the order that he does. The wife should not separate from her husband. That would have been really her only recourse. She could divorce. Corinth was a different story. There were really no legal obstacles to the practice. So Paul's kind of writing from his own Jewish background in terms of the wife separating from her husband, you know, is to the extent that she could go. But anyway, she must remain unmarried. There's an exception to make the best of the situation. So if the differences are irreconcilable, then she should remain unmarried. Okay. And then Paul prohibits husbands from divorcing. Takes his standards not from culture, but from the word of the Lord, like we've just talked about. All right, moving on. Verses 12 through 16.
To the rest I say, I, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. For how do you know, wife, whether you will not save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will not save your wife?
So here are the mixed marriages with Christians and unbelievers. Willing to live with him or her, that goes beyond cohabitation. The relationship should remain a marriage. So it's not just a tolerance that Paul has in view, or a, you know, sharing the same roof. The idea is that they live as married people, right? So what is Paul meaning here in terms of, well, just in the whole context, what do you think all this is saying?
Seems to be talking about those that are believers and the partner is not, or vice versa, you know? So I still don't necessarily understand that if one believes and one isn't, that the children are holy or not. That doesn't make sense to me, but sometimes I read this stuff and it doesn't make sense to me. So,
well, we're going to get to that question too. That's an interesting word. Earlier, Paul had warned against associating with the immoral. So expel the immoral brother, disassociate with people who are living like pagans. So some may have been arguing that a marriage to a pagan may defile the Christian. And if you go back and, you know, with that idea in view, look at what Paul was writing earlier, now we might be making some sense of it. So was there a move for believers then to separate from their unbelieving spouse because they had this idea, well, if I stay with this person, then I am unholy, I am unclean because now I have an unbelieving a partner, husband or wife, right? So that might be the case, actually. And that gives some maybe background as a possibility. Again, this is one of those things where we don't know because Paul doesn't ever say, but is that what was happening in the context of Corinth? Was that move being done so that this would then be Paul saying, wait, before you go doing that, don't bust up homes because somebody believes and somebody doesn't. That doesn't make sense. That's not really God's plan for this. Instead, if you're able to stay in the marriage, then you should. Okay. The unbeliever is sanctified through the association. Well, what the heck does that mean? Right. Made holy. What does that mean here? What doesn't it mean? So Barry, this is the question that you pointed us toward. What does that mean? Unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife. Unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. What? The children, as it is, they are holy. Does this mean these are now pure and perfect unbelieving people?
So is it the type of thing that if you're a Christian and your wife isn't, but because you're married, she's now part of God's family because you are?
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough in the light of, you know, normally we think of your faith as, you know, as your personal decision, I don't know, isn't the right word, but you're accepting God into your heart sort of thing, you know, Holy Spirit. So yeah, it's pretty strange when he talks in this way.
I think it's implying that the Christian half of the couple has influence over the other. And this is probably a beneficial thing, and it may lead to a new believer coming into the flock.
That's how we take it. We don't take it as the person is pure and holy because of the faith of someone else, but more that there's an influence, you know, a tone of the household, an impact that happens because there is moral purity and faith inside the house. Okay. So Lockwood's commentary says, to say that the unbelieving spouse, quote, has been sanctified, which is verse 14, does not necessarily mean that he or she will be saved. As much as the believing spouse may desire and pray for the partner's salvation and proclaim the gospel, the unbeliever may continue to reject the gospel. However, the unbelieving spouse does come under the holy influence of the Christian. So, similar to what Roger was saying, right? So, I think there's some struggle that we have with this whole idea and the way that we read these words about made holy sounds like a done deal. And I think the implication that's there is shouldn't make give us this like it's a, you know, past perfect kind of verb, but more of a progressive sense. Because if you go to verse 16, you look at, you know, the questions that Paul asks, okay? But we'll get there in just a second. There's a clause allowing the end of the marriage, let it be so. That's if the non-believing person separates, let it be so. Just imagine for a second how many Christian women and possibly men in Corinth may have been struggling to keep a marriage going, and for what reason? Or reasons?
Well, I think this passage provides, like you were saying earlier, we were listening on the way home, that there may be, you know, this fear if you become a Christian, say after you had married, you know, you were both unbelievers, but one spouse becomes Christian or something. There may be this sense, well, I'm being defiled by my spouse, and I need to get out of this because it's going to drag me down. And like you say, this house won't be spiritual. So in the sense of what he's saying here, it definitely makes sound like, well, you can still maintain your faith and Christ and the holiness of the home, you know, like you say. So in other words, there's this battle going on in the home and especially when you have sex, you know, because then you're joining together. So it's like, who wins? And he's saying here, you know, you don't have, you know, Satan doesn't win somehow, you know, in this, you know, it's like, you know, I'm stronger than Satan, you know, and so you can continue in this relationship and still be under the blessing of God and maintain your faith and maybe even possibly, you know, someday convert the person. Now, obviously it can go the other way too. We know, because we've probably seen that too in the real world, but he's saying that there is this possibility and that, I guess that's how I would look at it, you know, and so therefore I'm telling you to stay together and don't divorce because of the mixed marriage thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think for the most part, what Paul is saying in terms of leave or not leave, to divorce or not divorce, he's driving back toward the divorce is not the ideal situation, right? And so if there are, you know, a person comes to faith and it potentially has an impact on personality, on priority, on all kinds of things, right? And so in the context of Corinth, where there's an anything goes society, all of a sudden a person comes to faith is like, whoa, I actually don't think I should go to the temple anymore, or I shouldn't maybe eat that food anymore, or whatever it is. And Paul's going to get to some of those other things in terms of like idols and whatever. And so there's a marriage relationship might have some tension in it because of those things. And so, you know, Paul's recommendation is you stay married, but if the unbeliever can't do it, won't do it, then rather than sacrifice one's faith, and I think that's part of what he's saying in terms of let it be so, you know, don't throw your faith away because you want to save your marriage. It's better to save your soul, right? And so I think that's part of it as well. All right. God has called you to peace, which is an interesting clause, I guess. You know, how does that fit with the whole argument? Is that peace within the home, peace within the soul? I mean, that's a little bit tough. There's some rhetorical questions that Paul then asks. How would you know if you're going to save the person? And I think that, again, is getting to your faith is important. If you could save your husband or save your wife through your action and activity staying in the marriage, then great. But if you can't, you're better having separated, and so let it be so. And I think that's what he's getting at with those rhetorical questions. All right. We're going to move quickly now to the next piece. We're going to skip over verses 17 to 24 because there's more marriage stuff below that. 17 to 24, the editorial heading is live as you are called. Okay. And so then Paul gets into some examples like circumcision. If you weren't circumcised, you don't have to get circumcised. If you were, that's fine. You should remain in the condition. If you're a servant, you know, if you're free, and those kinds of things, you were bought with a price, bond servant, etc. So there's, it's almost like Paul gives some examples about remaining as you are. And the reason he does that is to really set up what we're going to read in the next 11 verses. So we're just going to jump to those 11 verses and not worry so much about the foundational parts that Paul's writing. So would someone read 25 to 35?
I will. Now about virgins, I have no command from the Lord, but I give a judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. Because of the present crisis, I think that it's good for a man to remain as he is. Are you pledged to a woman? Do not seek to be released. Are you free from such a commitment? Do not look for a wife. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. But those who marry will face many troubles in this life. And I want to spare you this. What I mean, brothers and sisters, is that the time is short. From now on, who have wives should live as if they do not. Those who mourn as if they did not. Those who are happy as if they were not. Those who buy something as if it were not theirs to keep. Those who use the things of the world as if not engrossed in them. For this world in its present form is passing away. I would like you to be free from concern. An unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affairs. Now he can please the Lord. But a married man is concerned about the affairs of his world, how he can please his wife. And his interests are divided. An unmarried woman or virgin is concerned about the Lord's affairs. Her aim is to be devoted to the Lord in both body and spirit. But a married woman is concerned about the affairs of this world, how she can please her husband. I am saying this for your own good, not to restrict you, but that you may live in a right way in undivided devotion to the Lord.
All right. Thanks, Andrea. So then Paul addresses the last group about marriage, those planning to be married or never. And so it's, you know, which is it? The word in the translation that, Andrea, what version do you have?
Just straight NIV.
NIV, okay. So that translated the word as virgin, and yes, that's actually the same word that is used for Mary, Parthenos in Greek. which you might recognize from the Parthenon, which is named that because of the virgins who would hang out at the temple. Paul addresses now that last group, okay? So it's likely referring again to a question from the Corinthians. So if you look at verse 25, and you look at chapter 7, verse 1, now concerning, or now about, 7 verse 1 said now concerning, at least in the translation I'm looking at. So it's the same way that it's introduced. So did they ask a question specific about those who are unmarried and have not been married thus far in their lives? Likely. That's what it seems like anyway. So here Paul uses his own pastoral judgment because there's no command or precedent that he can refer back to. So there's a suggestion, or Paul's suggestion, there's a continuity with what he's just said, remain as you are. So that's the section we skipped, remain as you are. And that's the end of verse 26, okay? So here's a question, what's the present distress?
That's the key.
Verse 26, I think that in view of the present distress is a good for a person to remain as he is. What do you think of those? What's Paul talking about?
Must have been something going on.
We must be talking about the pressures of life that are going on in Corinth at that time, right?
Okay.
And because he's talking about the sexual morality and all that stuff going on in prior sections, I think that's more what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, this is one of those questions that we don't have an answer to. And there's plenty of those because we're reading somebody else's mail, right? So they're going to know what the distress is. They're going to know what the problem is, and we don't necessarily get to know exactly, but the end of the world, live as the time is short, that he gets to in the next section. So was he kind of anticipating that already as he writes? Maybe. Was there a specific cause of distress in Corinth, especially within the church? And I think, Barry, this is kind of what you were more pointing toward is, there must have been something going on there in the current situation that was happening, the present distress that was happening related to their specific situation. There's extra biblical evidence. So from outside the Bible, we know that there was a famine in the area about the time that Paul wrote. So there's this famine happening and if people are starving and there's a lack of food, does that help us understand that? That's tough because what's that have to do with people who've not yet been married? It's a tough question. So does this advice seem appropriate if there was a famine? I guess I kind of already tipped my hand on that question. So honestly, the answer is we don't know. We don't know what the present distress was, and it could have been a number of things or a combination.
If we apply it to the famine theory, maybe it does, because then you can focus on, food and that sort of stuff and not have to worry about a wife or children or that whole thing.
Well, that's a good way to look at it. And so it is a possibility more than what I originally, his gut reaction was like, food or no food, better to marry than to burn. All right,
the church crisis. I mean, there was the diaspora, right? Everybody was just kind of, the Christians were driven from Jerusalem and Israel area, right, into places like Corinth, Corinth and other places. But I mean, that my sense was that wouldn't create a lot of pressure in Corinth, but I don't know if is that true.
Yeah. And maybe, you know, it could have been a combination of persecution happening, famine happening, the Corinthian culture and society influence that they were under, and just kind of all of that. So all possibilities, we can't say with certainty. But even without the crisis, Paul's words are consistent with earlier sections. So if you're married, don't divorce. If you're not married, remain single. But marrying is not sinful. How about the worldly troubles part? If you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a betrothed woman, this is in the ESV version, probably I think Andrea said, if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. Yet those who marry will have worldly troubles. What do you think?
Seems like you're going to face the troubles whether or not you're married, right?
Yeah. I mean, he talks about anxiety that a married person has over pleasing a spouse. He even describes that pretty directly, right? But to connect back to what Barry said, that could be accentuated if there was a crisis, particularly a famine. You know, now you got to provide food for two and not just one. So that might be worldly trouble. Clarifies some, at least in verses 32 to 35, about anxiety, about that a married person would have trouble. Verses 32 to 35, so then Paul makes a contrast between married and unmarried people. So just to revisit that text, I want you to be free from anxiety. The unmarried man is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to please the Lord, but the married man is anxious about worldly things, how to please his wife. What do you think? Is that accurate? Are unmarried people free to serve the Lord with single-minded devotion? I see a head nodding, or shaking, I should say.
Maybe a little more so in one aspect, but not anymore because they're still in the world. They still have the same problems.
Same distractions.
And they burn.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the
if or you with can, passion. Yeah.
Earlier in this chapter. Right, exactly. If you're single and you're not married, you got this burning passion problem and you can't exercise self-control, you better get married. But if you're married, you're going to have this worldly anxiety and what?
Well, so my interpretation is that, yeah, I mean, it seems like on the surface that if you're single, that you could have this single-minded devotion to the Lord. But when you're married, you know, you think, oh, well, you're serving your wife and the Lord, but isn't serving your wife also glorifying God?
That is a really good point. Exactly. So, I don't know, Paul. The married man is anxious about worldly things. The interests are divided.
I mean, if you're got to have a godly wife, you know, a godly spouse, then the spouse would be encouraging you, you would think, you know, whereas if you're alone, then you're more apt to stray. I mean, so it seems like you could look at it, you know, both ways, you know.
Right.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things it reminds us of for those of us who are around a long time at Mount Olive, I think Tom and maybe Johnny and Andrea can remember this, and Linda too. There was a sermon that, Pat Simmons did, or an illustration that Pat Simmons did, and it had to do with spinning plates, and you had to keep all the plates spinning. So as you got more plates, your attention got more divided to try and keep all the plates spinning. So essentially, if you're married and, you know, you have kids or whatever, you have to keep those plates spinning while you're trying to serve God. So it's more difficult. Your attention is divided. So that's, I think, the argument of, you know, if you're unmarried, then it's easier to stay single focused on the Lord. So I'm throwing it both ways here. I'm messing with it to answer both directions.
Right. And I think that's, I mean, our struggle is because we can see both sides of that. And I think that's why it's hard for us to agree with what Paul is writing here. you know, really, Paul? Because you just got done saying just a few verses ago that it's better to marry than to burn. And if we're burning with passion, I don't think we're serving the Lord so well, right? If we're so distracted that we, you know, are tempted or whatever, I don't know that we're serving the Lord and only anxious about pleasing the Lord.
Mm-hmm. In a perfect world, I could see his argument, I guess.
Right. So, I mean, there's something to be said for a person who doesn't have the burden of providing for others or the divided time. And the spinning plates is a great illustration of it. Mm-hmm. But is that God's call for everybody? And Paul has said, you know, a few times already, you know, no, don't aspire necessarily to a life of singleness. He consistently encourages Christians not to live for themselves, but to live for the Lord. That's true, right? And so that's more what he's diving at. So, you know, Paul commends celibacy here while not making it a rule. He never says that being married displeases God, even in the case of the mixed marriage, which just to kind of understand that context too, mixed marriage was forbidden to the Jewish people. You know, to intermarry with the people they were supposed to drive out of the land was strictly forbidden, and they needed to stay within their own people, right? So in Corinth, Paul comes back and says, you know, wait, before we wreck a bunch of families, right? That's just kind of backing up just for a second to understand that Jewish context. So he never says that being married is a displeasing thing to God. All right, just a couple sections left and we'll wrap it up for today. Verses 36 to 38. If someone would read that, that'd be great.
I can read it.
Oh, you got it.
This is Ron. If anyone thinks that he is not behaving properly towards his betrothed, if his passions are strong and it has to be, let him do as he wishes. Let him marry, it is no sin. But whoever is firmly established in his heart, being under no necessity, but having his desire under control, and has determined this in his heart to keep her betrothed as his betrothed, he will do well. So then when he who marries his betrothed does well, and he who refrains from marriage will do even better.
All right. We good on that? Anybody have a betrothed? And the word again is virgin. So challenging to us to understand what he's really driving at. But the way that the commentary takes it, this section is really for engaged couples who may be postponing a wedding. So if one is engaged and you're thinking, maybe we postpone the marriage and the wedding because of this new faith. So that's a possibility. So they should get married. Remember Paul's words to the widowers in verses 8 and 9, widows and widowers both. They should get married if they don't have self-control. So let them marry, it's good. It's not a sin, it's verse 36. But then there's another commendation for remaining unmarried while not looking down on marriage at the same time. So it's consistent. This one's a little bit more difficult, I think, for us to unpack and understand. And I think there's the idea of betrothal. We look at it really as like, we look at it as an engagement. It's a little bit more significant and serious than that. So it is a period of time kind of after the couple is committed to one another, but before they are married. So in some ways it's a lot like our engagement, but it is, I guess, more of a firm commitment than what engagement how engagement is looked at in our time and culture. All right, we good on that? And let's finish up with verses 39 and 40. Tom, if you're there, go ahead. You were about to read it.
39, a woman is bound to her husband as long as he lives. But if her husband dies, she is free to marry anyone she wishes, but he must belong to the Lord. In my judgment, she is happier if she stays as she is. And I think that I too have the spirit of God.
All right. So Paul closes the chapter addressing widows. Now they are free to remarry. But as he writes that, it's remarry those of faith. Okay. So Christians, believers. But again, here he is commending remaining single. And, you know, Paul's writing from his own experience in his own context. And I think we have to keep that in mind. So Paul must have had the ability to be a single person and serve the Lord with a single-minded devotion. And maybe as he's writing, he's overestimating everybody else's ability to be like him. or maybe underestimating the temptation that people in Corinth would face. He'd been there, so he'd seen, you know, he'd been to Vegas. He'd been down the Vegas Strip, so to speak, in Corinth. So he'd seen it, he'd visited it, but did Paul recognize the struggle that maybe the people of Corinth would have? I don't know. Or maybe he knew of other people who were in a similar kind of state. And, you know, it's a possibility that there would be people that he would have already known that he was commending there in Corinth, even that, you know, maybe there were some who were being pressured to marry again, or maybe some who were being pressured not to marry again. And so he was saying, look, if they need to get married, get married. If you don't need to get married, don't get married. And it's fine. There's not a perfect way or a right way or, you know, a way that's better than the other way. Honestly, just serve God however you are. Remain how you are. If you're married, be married. If you are single, be single, but then serve the Lord in that context that you live in. All right. Summary for today. Paul is commending celibacy while not making it a command or some exalted state about being married. If the ascetic life was being promoted in Corinth, the whole idea that marriage is maybe no good or, you know, refraining from sexuality, if that was being promoted in Corinth, Paul doesn't agree with those ideas, right? And it seems to indicate, right, that there's some way that that was being suggested or church in Corinth, because that's who he's addressing here, right? So he says this a number of times. Marriage is good. Sexuality in marriage is good. Dissolving a marriage is against God's word and God's will. So as much as we can, we remain married because this is the design. This is the plan. But he recognizes for those gifted with self-control, the single life does allow freedom to serve the Lord with fewer troubles. And, you know, I can understand that. For those gifted with self-control, again, both ways of life are pleasing to the Lord and are valid for Christians. Okay. Thoughts, questions, comments?
The one strong, I think, thing in here is that you don't marry a non-believer thinking that you're going to convert them. Because you will hear that a lot, you know, somebody will say, well, I know he's not a non-believer, but I'm going to convert him, you know?
Yeah.
So that's kind of a key thing. So a lot of what he's talking about is like, you're already in this relationship.
Yes. But it's still okay to do and let God go to work, because God's work might be to convert them through that person. So it's I think that opens it up and says, you know, it's okay, but don't expect it. Like you say, it shouldn't be right. The reason you get married is to convert someone.
Yeah. Let's not look at marriage as the mission field. This is how we're going to convert the world, is by sending all of our unmarried people to find an unbelieving person to marry. And then we'll double our numbers that way. If you were planning to write that on the outreach survey, I can tell you now that's not going to be our plan.
One thing I caught in the verse 40 that I seem to imply that maybe Paul was a widower, because of the way it says it, yet in my judgment, she is happier if she remains as she is, the widow he's talking about. And I think that I too have the Spirit of God. So he seems to be implying that he's a widower.
Yeah. And I can see that too there. And it's interesting that throughout this whole chapter, there was a lot of balance between male and female parts of it, right? There's a bit more dominance of the masculine in verses 36 and 38 in terms of the betrothed or the virgin, if we take it that more literal way. There's not a lot there that's like, what about her? What about her rights or her, you know, idea? And then in the next section, it's really more about the wife being bound to the husband. And if she's a widow, then, you know, here it goes. So probably this was doing two things. One was identifying that there was probably more widows than widowers, which most likely had to do with the ages of people when they were getting married, that it was not uncommon for men to be significantly older than the women at the time.
Right.
Maybe more Jewish culture than Corinthian culture would have been that way. That would be an interesting thing to try to look for, is what were ages of people when they got married in Corinth or Greco-Roman culture generally. But maybe there were just more widows than widowers. So at the end, he's coming back to the widows because he knew there were some. But then the prior section, the betrothed couple, the man had a dominant kind of role in the betrothal, and then what happened moving forward from that. And so I think Paul is just recognizing that reality, not necessarily endorsing it or supporting it. I mean, I think there's good reason to, some of our equality of our gender roles in our culture, we can't read that back into Corinth and think that they were doing it wrong necessarily, just because we like how we do it or this is how we are right now, right? So more masculine dominance there. And so then, but then when you get, I mean, Barry, I just kind of come back to what you said, that I think I too have the same Spirit of God. I think that really does add to the argument that Paul was a widower. And so he's a single person and is serving the Lord with this single-minded devotion. He's a widower, so he has been married. So he understands marriage, and he can speak to it from an insider, or at least a formerly insider, without being like the guy who's like, you know, oh, married people, this is how it is for you, if he didn't know, right?
Yeah.
You got a lot more authority if you've been married to talk about.
Yeah, problems with that. Yeah, it is good to, I mean, if you look at this section in general, if it's coming from the perspective of someone who was never married, then it's a little more tough to take. But if it's coming from someone that was married, you can understand, you know, that they've seen both sides of it. And being a widower is a very different situation than being single and never married.
Yeah, certainly. And if Paul's wife had left him, I think at some point that would come out in a, especially if he's talking about divorce and things like that. And, though she would, you know, is that part of his commentary on the, if the unbelieving spouse won't do it. And that's a good question too. But I mean, I think I like the idea that he was a widower. it really does connect with a couple of spots here in this chapter in particular. But
yeah,
again, like we've said a few times through today's conversation, we don't know and we can't make stuff up. It's not a good idea. Well, let's close in prayer. God, we seek your direction for our lives and as people who are married. We thank you for our marriages and for our wives and husbands. And Lord, we pray for these relationships that we have and enjoy. Lord, we pray also that we would serve you in the roles that you have for us, in the capacity that you desire for us, and in the fullness that is your desire, that we would prioritize how we live our lives according to your plan for us. God, guide us and direct us by your word, that we would not let the culture around us dictate how we live, but we would live according to your plans. Lord, go with us throughout this week, and that we would be about your business. In Jesus' name, amen.